Open the Senate Committee on Education and General Government, and thank you all for coming today. Our chair had a commitment in Portland and was unable to be here, and we expect, oh good, we do have a quorum. The order that we're going to take today is we will hear Senate Bill 907 first, then we'll have the public hearing on 681, and then a public hearing on 152 and a possible work session on 152. So that's the agenda today. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 907. And we have Senator Monroe, Representative Smith, is he here, and Mayor Sam Adams. So we'd welcome you to...
Mr. Chair, could we have Dana explain the bill?
Oh.
We do that, yes.
Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 907 permits a local government under certain conditions to attach a discretionary approval standards or special conditions regulating appearance or aesthetics to an application for development of needed housing or to permit for a residential development. You do have a minimal fiscal impact statement and a no revenue impact statement, and that is everything.
Thank you, Senator Morris, members of the committee. I'm Rod Monroe, Senate District 24, which is the eastern part of the city of Portland and includes Happy Valley. The folks in my district, the David Douglas area, the eastern part of the city, what sometimes used to be called the Mid-County, have kind of for a long time felt like poor stepchildren in that they felt like downtown Portland was ignoring them, that downtown Portland was doing nice things to develop downtown Portland, the Pearl District, and that gentrification throughout the inner city neighborhoods was pushing lower-income people more and more out into the mid-county area, and that developers were putting up sometimes some rather flimsy apartment developments and infill developments that didn't last very long and quickly became slums. But when the city of Portland came to me at the beginning of the year with the idea of introducing Senate Bill 907, I was happy to do that because I think it'll have tremendous benefit to the people that I represent. There's going to be at least 1 million new residents in the next 20 years in the greater Portland area, and we need to plan smartly and leverage public investments appropriately to provide for the kind of housing needs. What I say is that people that happen to be poor or people that happen to be elderly or handicapped should not be forced to live in slums. They should have nice developments to live in. And this bill is designed to do that, to improve the overall quality of life of tenants, to improve the privacy and security, to have useful open public places, energy efficiency, and to coordinate development with the tremendous transit investments that we have made in our district, primarily the light rail line that runs from Gresham into downtown Portland. That investment can best be utilized by quality projects along and near every stop. Now, since I introduced this bill and since the chair decided to go ahead and grant this hearing, I've heard from some folks in the development industry that have some comments and concerns about some of the some portions of this measure. And so what I've asked for is a work group to be constituted. I've asked Randy Tucker, he's the lobbyist for Metro. He understands transit-oriented development. He understands good development practices perhaps better than anybody in the state. And he has agreed to conduct a work group early next week that will include longtime folks from the development industry like Kelly Ross, John Chandler, and others. And also, of course, the city of Portland will be integrally involved in that. We believe that they can produce some rather simple amendments that will enable us to have quality development in my district along the light rail line without impeding responsible developers from an opportunity to create some of the projects that you'll be hearing about today. I brought with me the mayor of Portland, Mr. Sam Adams, who will have some comments.
Mayor, welcome.
Thank you, Chair Morris. Really appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today on this important matter, and I want to acknowledge the ongoing and lengthy contribution of Senator Munro advocating for quality education, smart land use, and transportation planning, and just an all-around champion for community livability for all of Portland and all of the Portland region and beyond. As Portland aspires to build sustainable, livable neighborhoods and accommodate increased density, we need additional tools. The city currently has authority to require design review in three areas of the city and in three areas of the city only: the Central City, the downtown area, the Gateway District in East Portland, and in historic districts. In the downtown area, the city has had 35 years of applying this tool. However, in other areas of the city, the developer has the option of choosing whether to go through a design review process or build according to a set of numeric standards. Senate Bill 907 extends Portland's existing design review authority in a limited way to those areas of the city where we are experiencing rapid growth and will continue to expect growth over the next 20 years as we invest hundreds of millions of dollars in transportation infrastructure in town centers, main streets, corridors, and light rail station communities. The bill only applies, to medium and high density residential developments of 18 dwelling units or more per acre. Design review is a priority for community members that are forced to live in and around poorly designed buildings. This issue is particularly important to residents of East Portland, and this bill results from recommendations from the East Portland Action Plan, which is a grassroots effort of businesses and political leaders and residents to come forward with what they believe is necessary to improve East Portland and, as Senator Munro said, put East Portland on an equal playing field with the rest of the city. To illustrate the problem, I'd like to draw your attention to the handout entitled Limitations of Objective Design Standards. And beginning on page 4, you will see examples of projects that complied with objective design standards and projects that went through the discretionary design review process. And as I think is very evident in the pictures, the stark difference between the quality and desirability of the housing couldn't be greater. You can see that a numeric standard process that can only achieve a one-size-fits-all approach. And relying on numeric standards is like designing a car with only engineers using slide rulers and no designers. In other words, generic, off-the-shelf, barrack-style designs can meet numeric standards but fail to account for the convergence of multiple design features and unique site characteristics. I'd also like to highlight a couple of letters supporting this bill. Included in your packet are letters from Kathleen McNaughton, a residential realtor with the Realty Trust Group, who during her 30-year career has represented builders and developers, and also a letter from Nick Sabi, the executive director of Rose Community Development, a nonprofit revitalization organization of affordable housing projects, including actually 40 housing projects in Southeast Portland. Both Nick and Kathleen recognize the need for SB 907 and recognize the long-term community and financial benefits of good design in neighborhoods across the city. Before I conclude, I would like to make a few more points about why I think this legislation is necessary. First, we need design review to accommodate growth. The metropolitan region, as Senator Munro mentioned, we're going to see at least a million new people in the next 20 years. A significant portion of those will go into the city of Portland. One of the most common complaints I get from folks, especially in East Portland, is why you, the city council, are letting these schlocky developments go into my neighborhood. You promised quality growth. Well, we don't have the tools in all parts of the city to help partner with private investors and developers to ensure more quality growth. The city's 35-year history, I just want to reinforce, successfully applying design review guidelines is a reason I believe this bill only deals with the city of Portland, and a reason I believe, given that success, to allow us to expand it within the city of Portland. previous legislation in previous sessions had it apply to all metropolitan areas. I believe that this would serve as a pilot test for the legislature that we can learn from, expect review on it, and would serve you well potentially as a predicate for application every place or other places in the state. Lastly, the independent analysis for design review was mentioned in the 1999 Portland City Club report called Increasing Density in Portlanders, and mentioned majority recommendations that design review should occur for all new medium and large-scale projects throughout the city. Again, thank you for an opportunity to give you a little bit of background. Again, thank you to Senator Monroe, Chair Morris, for your and the entire committee for your consideration of this issue.
Thank you. Any questions? I do have a question, and there may be other witnesses that would answer this as well. ORS 197-307 addresses low income, middle income, and fixed income. And my question would be that when you look at the comparables that you have between objective and discretionary, what is the resulting increase in cost for these additional design features? And if there's a factor involved that, of course, would translate into rent charges.
Actually, it's interesting because many times the quality projects are public-private partnership money through transit-oriented development, federal money, and other money in combination with private money. So often they can produce a quality project for no higher cost and even sometimes a lower cost than these prefab cracker box developments, infill developments that are done for as cheaply as possible. And so we've found that rents in these facilities, and they all of them have low-income components, so a certain portion of the units have to be designed for low income. So we found that rents are no higher. The only thing that's higher is the quality of life.
And Sam, maybe you want to...
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's often posed as either good design or affordability, and I think those are false choices. For the more poorly designed and poorly built projects, the tenants end up paying more in different ways. If you look through some of these examples, we know that public safety, environmental considerations, when you have these kinds of human warehouses, are attractors for crime. We know that when something is built substandard, that it is going to, you know, with poor quality furnishings, that it's going to cost the tenants more. We have a long track record, not only in the public-private developments, as Senator Monroe talked about, but in private-only developments of providing affordability and good design. Quality developers, thoughtful developers, have nothing to fear from what we're suggesting. And that's why I'm supportive of Senator Monroe's effort to have the work group come together to make it very clear for developers that want to provide affordability and want to do it in a way that is good for the surrounding neighborhood in terms of infill, that, you know, that we are rewarding and greenlighting those quality developers who also provide affordability. It's the developers who come in and just do their rip sort of schlock stuff those are the ones that this bill is aimed at.
And Representative Smith has joined us. He's a colleague of mine, and he represents the same areas that I do.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. I have not been involved, for the record, Representative Jefferson Smith, representing District 47. I have not been involved in the drafting or conceiving of the bill, but I do want to offer some background and support for Senator Monroe's bill and the work of the city. One of the things that has disadvantaged my district is poorly designed, unplanned infill development. One set of units along the MAX line that was shared with me by law enforcement in my district, I believe there are 165 police complaints in a single year, in part because of lack of sight lines and lack of buffer between the MAX line and the entrance to that set of units. which the police noted to me in particular. I have passed out, or I hope the committee system, I believe, passed out a map that shows the growth in Section 8 housing in the city of Portland. You will notice, if you look, that almost all of the significant growth areas are east of 82nd. If you compare that to a map that was too big for me to make copies, or I guess we didn't make copies just before, but we can provide it, you will notice that it does not link up very well. You'll see the sort of the half circle of dots that does not link up pretty well where the unplanned housing is gone. So what we have is a set of private unplanned housing for low-income folks going in and contributing to the highest growth in crime that we have seen in the city of Portland and the state of Oregon, I believe. I want to offer just a few more thoughts. A better review process will lead to more communication between residents, developers, and planners as to how our neighborhoods should look and what they should be like to live in. I want to offer the example of where my parents live in the Irvington neighborhood, where we had, when I was a child, some crime challenges relatively close to where my home was. Residents got together and made sure that new homes in the area were built with porches. A very simple thing, and that contributed to turnaround in the neighborhood. I also want to link this to two things that I know are of concern to members of this committee and to members of the chamber. I want to talk about how our planning and design decisions link and relate to teen pregnancy and juvenile crime. When we can design neighborhoods that aren't ghettoized, where we can make sure that a little bit over 5%, at least 5% of the people living in a neighborhood are working professionals, people who get dressed to go to work, we can see similar juvenile crime and teen pregnancy stats as neighborhoods with 40% of people in the neighborhood who get dressed to go to work, working professionals. But the moment you dip below 5%, the moment you ghettoize, don't plan, don't provide sight lines, don't provide common areas, you have skyrocketing teen pregnancy and skyrocketing juvenile crime. And that inures to the cost of the state and the cost of residents beyond. Discretionary design review can help foster equity of design development for areas like my district. And I promised myself I would be 3 minutes, and I was. Thanks very much, members of the committee.
Well, thank you, Representative. Any questions?
I have a quick question, Mr. Vice Chair. Thank you. I'm looking at the map that was provided, Mayor Adams, and I wonder, this shows where the existing areas. Is there a way to tell, or do you have a map that will show if Senate Bill 907 is passed, what areas are going to be included in that discretionary design review?
We can provide. Bob Clay?
If you don't have it today, that's fine. I just think I would be interested in seeing that. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Clay with the City of Portland Bureau of Planning. If you look on that map, there are shaded areas, and those shaded areas denote what are referred to as Region 2040 design type areas. So the shading areas show you main streets where the light rail station communities are located. So the bill is very specific about the specific geography that the provisions are limited to, and they're limited to elements that are part of the regional growth concept, a framework plan that's developed by Metro in cooperation with the city. So these are areas that are targeted by the region and by the city for additional growth, and those are the areas that we would this would enable the City of Portland to be able to provide a design review in the future. I should point out that the bill is only enabling. The city would need to go through a very lengthy public involvement process with the Planning Commission and City Council before it would ever make a decision about adding any additional design overlays where this provision would apply.
Thank you.
Okay. Any further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The next panel will be Bill Wilson, Mark White, and Linda Netkoven. If I pronounced that incorrectly, please correct me.
That was very close.
Whoever's ready to go.
Okay.
Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you for this opportunity. My name is Bill Wilson with William Wilson Architects in Portland. I'm here to speak in support of Senate Bill 907. Expanding the design review to medium and high density neighborhoods in Portland is very necessary. Projects developed under discretionary design review processes are routinely superior to projects developed under prescriptive standards. My firm, William Wilson Architects, has been designing affordable and mixed-use urban housing for over 30 years, many projects in the East Portland area on light rail transit stations and in town centers, also many going through the City of Portland design review process. And we have a good feel for what it takes to do a good project. Our projects are generally noted for achieving high-quality design while obtaining city approvals, acquiring neighborhood acceptance, and meeting our mostly nonprofit clients' budgets and schedules. Good design requires an integrated process of teamwork between responsible developers and experienced design professionals. Flexible design guidelines interpreted by qualified planners assist in this process. Poor quality design and unimaginative design solutions often result from prescriptive design standards or no design standards at all. I want to speak briefly about some specific design issues. Good design considers many issues and resolves many issues, all in kind of an integrated process. Good design must be site-specific, not off-the-shelf. Consideration needs to be given to such factors as surrounding neighborhood character and scale, site size, site shape, topography, solar orientation, existing landscape, and adjacent traffic patterns, as well as other matters. Good design always promotes a sense of community by providing usable open space and safe pedestrian connections within neighborhoods and to transit stations. In addition, the pedestrian experience on adjacent streets, resident security, and privacy should also be addressed. Also, the opportunities to incorporate sustainable design features such as on-site stormwater treatment, natural daylighting and ventilation, recycled materials are also important, as well as building scale and massing, and respecting the existing development patterns and anticipating future development patterns in the neighborhood. Prescriptive design standards do not adequately address these and the many other integrated design considerations. Good design does not necessarily cost more. As I mentioned, most of our clients and projects are developed with nonprofit organizations and on affordable housing budgets. There's no increase in construction costs for such things as building orientation, window placement, or the arrangement of countless other building components. Also, good design pays benefits. Higher quality buildings cost less to maintain and last longer. When people take pride in their living environment, they take better care of it. More sustainable buildings have direct paybacks to the residents, the owners, and to the community at large. A discretionary design review process does not necessarily increase project development timelines. With the flexibility and informal feedback built into the process and good communication between the planners and the neighborhood and the design team, generally all of these processes can be conducted concurrently and not necessarily increase the timelines of the project. Our citizens demand good design where high densities are targeted. Communities are more accepting of high density when included in the process and their voices are heard. A discretionary design review process ensures neighborhood participation in this process. A prescriptive process does not. I strongly support the passage of Senate Bill 907 and thank you for your time. Good design matters.
Thank you.
Who's next? My name is Mark White. I'm the president of the Palhurst-Gilbert Neighborhood Association, and I'm testifying here on their behalf. Palhurst-Gilbert is the most populated neighborhood in the city of Portland. Population estimates are in the area of 12,500 households, or approximately 30,000 people. That's about 5% of the total population of the city of Portland. The vast majority of our neighborhood is located within the David Douglas School District, which has an average annual enrollment increase of 3%. And our average family income is approximately $16,000 less than citywide. and the neighborhood is seriously lacking in basic infrastructure such as sidewalks and crosswalks. The challenges noted above, as well as numerous others, are a result of growth that's happened in just the last several years. Complicating this growth is that while the City of Portland has a discretionary design review in three areas within the city, their hands are effectively tied in having this authority in other much-needed areas of the city, like our neighborhood. We feel it's important to note that this legislation does not just affect the front end of design, but also the back end with regard to the level of livability with the resulting construction. Our neighborhood is unique among many in the city because our large lots and availability of inexpensive land, which is why we have such incredible growth. However, we have also seen some of the poorest quality construction and follow-through by developers. It is our feeling that developers come in knowing that the city's authority is limited and subsequently know that there is little chance of being penalized for inferior construction and follow-through. There is certainly not enough time at this hearing to discuss all the problems we see, but I will be happy to discuss them with anyone who needs additional information in order to feel comfortable with approving the legislation. We feel very strongly that with more oversight on the front end, developers will be much less likely to cut corners throughout the building process as well as post-construction management. We very strongly support Senate Bill 907 and hope this hearing is a first step towards successful passage of this incredibly important piece of legislation. And I've added my contact information as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Linda?
Senator Morris and committee members, I'm Linda Nettikoven. I'm here to speak in favor of Senate Bill 907, and I thank you very much for the opportunity to do that. I moved to Oregon in 1971, and I've spent the last 10 years in Portland. During most of my time in Oregon, I've been very involved in neighborhood associations in several communities, both working as a staff person and also functioning as a neighbor. Working with land use reviews, I've seen a lot of very positive new development and also some extremely negative things. And with most of the growth, much of the growth that's expected to land in our state's largest metropolitan region, I think we're getting a little worried if we can't come up with some better tools to help that growth happen. My particular situation, which I didn't elaborate in the testimony before you, is I'm the vice chair of an inner east side neighborhood, meaning one of the old streetcar neighborhoods in Portland. My neighborhood is a monument to what happens without any kind of design review. We had intact single-family neighborhoods that are interrupted by shoddy, very poor quality multifamily housing that was built oftentimes in the 70s with no oversight, no opportunity to comment on it as it was going in. I currently personally live in an historic district, so this won't affect me, but the rest of my neighborhood and the many other neighborhoods that I work with across the city, we've been talking about this issue for many years, and it's a very great concern. What is facing us right now is the arrival of a light rail station, and neighbors are getting very concerned about what's going to happen, what this redevelopment means, what kind of say they can possibly have. We have some pieces of public land that could be redeveloped. We have a lot of private land, of course, around it, and we very much, this is infrastructure that's going to last for many decades, want to be able to optimize what gets built in a corner of our neighborhood. We raised our own money to fight to bring light rail back to our neighborhood after the ballot measure was defeated for the Southeast line, and now neighbors are starting to go, wait, I don't know if I want this. I don't know if I, you know, looking at some of the other high-density development that's going in around them, they're getting frightened. And we need to find a way to have a balanced, thoughtful conversation and approach to this infill as it happens, and to, again, be able to encourage the most sophisticated use of our limited resources as we go forward. We need to be creating neighborhoods that are safe and sustainable and have quality and character, and that people can watch grow and change and yet have enough of the character intact so they still feel like home and don't feel as though we've suddenly been yanked up by our roots and transplanted somewhere else. So I won't restate a lot of the comments that I have in my written testimony because others have made those points, but this bill provides a lot of opportunity, and I'm one of those people that will be on the neighborhood side wanting to very much work constructively, come up with a very useful, thorough, thoughtful process that doesn't add cost and doesn't belabor things and make them take longer than they should. We want things that are affordable as well as things that are well built. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions of the panel? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
I also submitted testimony from Bonnie McKnight, who asked me to bring it for her personally, and she's the chair of our citywide land use group that brings all of the neighborhood associations together.
Thank you very much. The next panel will be Randy Tucker, Roger Grahan, and Mel Stewart.
Good afternoon, Senator Morris, members of the committee. My name is Randy Tucker. I'm the Legislative Affairs Manager for Metro. I think you've heard a pretty good summary of the arguments in favor of this bill. I just like to put it in a little bit of context. As you know, Metro is the regional government of the Portland metropolitan area, and one of our responsibilities, well, actually our charter calls for us to undertake planning and policy making to preserve and enhance the quality of life and the environment for ourselves and future generations. And one of the major undertakings that has been completed in the region was the adoption of the 2040 growth concept, which is the long-range land use plan for the region that's intended to guide growth and development for the next several decades. And the references in the bill to centers and corridors and main streets, et cetera, come out of the 2040 growth concept. Just want to give you a short summary of some of the policies in the growth concept so you can see how they all kind of fit together and relate to this legislation. The growth concept calls for safe and stable neighborhoods for families, compact development, which uses land and money more efficiently, a healthy economy that generates jobs and business opportunities, protection of farms, forests, and natural areas, a balanced transportation system to move people and goods, and housing for people of all incomes in every community. All of those things in some way are affected by the kind of development that we build in the urban areas of the region. So as we seek to accommodate 1 million people in the next 30 years or whatever, 25, 30 some odd years in the Portland region, Metro and the region have committed themselves to trying to do that without unnecessarily expanding the urban growth boundary. Obviously, there are expansions that will happen, but we're trying to develop efficiently. And we can't accomplish the region's goals unless quality design is part of the equation. Because without quality design, you end up with a lot of opposition to the kind of developments that are necessary to accomplish those goals. So I'd just like to put that in for the record, also add that we believe that the goals of Senate Bill 907 can be achieved without unnecessary cost and delay, and so it's important that we be able to actually do the development that we're trying to accomplish rather than create barriers to it. So with that, I'll just offer myself for any questions.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. Randy, you mentioned you think this can be done without unnecessary cost and delay, and I wonder if you could expand a little bit on the unnecessary cost part.
I'm looking at the statute, Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici. I'm looking at the needed housing statute that speaks about clear and objective standards, but it also speaks about not discouraging the development of needed housing through unnecessary cost and delay. When the Metro Council considered this legislation, actually before last session, when the City of Portland was offering it, we had a fairly lengthy conversation with city staff about finding that balance. And the Metro Council felt at the end of the day that we could achieve that. That rather than increasing cost and delay, that this would encourage better housing on balance and better design, and it was going to be something that would be more beneficial in the long run than not.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next.
My name is Roger Grahan.
builder and developer and have been for about 40 years. I build almost exclusively affordable housing, both single-family and multiple-family. My understanding of Senate Bill 907 is that it gives Portland an exception to some of the state rules and more flexibility to do other things or whatever they want is what it comes down to. I recently completed a quality-built 30-unit affordable apartment project, because I believe in affordability, in Lentz, 82 in Powell, Felony Flats, it's commonly known. It's built at 48 units to the acre. And I'm probably, to my knowledge, I'm probably the only guy in town and maybe the state, I don't know, that builds affordable homes or housing with almost just my money. No assistance, no government, no nothing. Just me and my money. Now, despite all the city's assurances and so forth and so on, every step of the way along this project, I was obstructed or blocked or given some new reason why I can't do something. The only word they understand is no. And that was both in the development and the construction. For example, the plan check was promised in 8 to 10 weeks. When I got the plan check back and was finally ready to issue a permit, it had three minor red line corrections 11 months later. It took 5 months to approve the street project, because I had to build the street as well as the project itself. 5 months to approve a 300-foot street, perfectly straight, just connect this side to this side, that's all I had to do, connecting the dots. 5 months for the plan check. Took me 12 days to build the street. Constantly, what you hear is, well, I know that, so on, but here's how we do it here. Or, that's the way we do it. You point out the rules. You point out the state code. You said, that doesn't matter. This is how we do it. Altogether, it took 2 years. 5 months to build it, and 2 years to get it from start to finish. What I had done is I tore down an old slum and demoed the whole thing, threw all the scuzzbags and dealers and hookers and every other bottom-of-the-barrel person that there could be, you can imagine. The cops and I threw them out, tore it down, started over, and built a decent, nice, affordable project. Quality built. Everybody rented, without advertising, rented up in a month. People just come, can I come and live here? The policies and so on, the city's policies and what I hear here and what I've heard here from all these other people who have never built nothing in their life, they completely ignore cost and cost effectiveness. And the best example I can give you of that is that the city currently owns more than 1,000, a little over 1,000, I think it's 1,050, affordable homes, affordable places to live. On average, they've spent $248,000 a unit. They're currently proposing to build 200 more down in the River District. $50 million, 200 units. Do the math. $240 a copy. $240,000 a copy. I asked Commissioner Leonard in the state, in the city, how many, and this was it, I did this in Lentz, how many constituents does he have in Lentz that live in a $248,000 house? Not very many. But that's what they cost to build, for them to build affordable housing. And it's mostly because of their delays and their demands and their all this stuff that I hear in here and so on, which, frankly, between you and me, is just garbage. Schlocky construction and so on and so on. They need to read the codes and they need to go through the ordeals of their building inspectors, what they need. There's no such thing as schlocky construction. You're thinking back in the 70s and Randall's and all that stuff. I know, because I used to nail them together. I built my units for significantly less than $90,000. Everything. Now, where does that other $150,000 go? I don't know. But I'm here to tell you, building in Portland is not a fun thing. Never again for me. Never. I was told, I was warned, don't do it. But it'll be okay. I had some assurances from some senior staff members, and yeah, it'll be better. It wasn't. But the things that they're trying to do are only going to make it worse for the next guy. It won't be me, but for the next guy, it's going to be only worse. It's completely doable in a completely different manner. What the city of Portland does not need is more flexibility. What the city of Portland needs is to be made to understand that all the rules apply to all the people, not just some. And specifically, it needs, if they just follow all the rules all the time, things would be a lot easier and a lot better. Thank you.
Thank you. Next.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mel Stewart. I live at 5180 Zozel Avenue South, Salem, Oregon. I'm a very small builder, mostly retired. I'm doing two final projects, but I wanted to give you some familiarity with those two projects and what's happened. To start out with, just give you a little idea of how something gets built. The first thing we do is we go out and we look for a parcel of land that's properly zoned, meets all the requirements, for what we want to build, medium income housing, in this case, rental properties. We then check with the planning staff to make sure that what we want to do is outright permitted under the development code. We don't want to take any risk that we're going to buy the property, do all the engineering, go through all the preliminary steps that it takes to do something, and then find out we can't use it for its intended purposes. So we're very careful about surveying, engineering, doing all the preliminary steps correctly. And in two projects now, once we found the property, went through, made the application, purchased the property, then went through the development process. We had got an administrative approval for a partitioning from the planning director. Found that it met all the appropriate clear and objective standards within the code. We then had neighborhood associations appeal that approval, and what they wanted is no renters in their neighborhood. They just didn't want renters. They didn't think the quality of renters were good enough to live in their neighborhood, and they didn't want them. And as a result, the city council reversed that decision, and we're now in LUBA on that case. Now, because the statute is in place, we're confident that LUBA will reverse that decision. We'll get to build our affordable housing. I've never seen the quality of construction being the issue. It's usually neighborhood associations that don't want higher density, they don't want renters, and they don't want lower income people in their living room. And that's what discretionary standards get you. In practical effects, it's something that is almost unethical.
Okay. Any questions of the panel?
May I add a little footnote to that?
Go ahead.
My experiences. My neighbors were in a state of, semi-shock because of what was going on in my on this project or in this site that I had. My neighbors today love me because just by building the units itself and throwing everybody, all the bad out, and starting over with the good, it upgraded the whole neighborhood. Everything is different today. Everything is different today. High density doesn't necessarily mean it. And Senator Morris, you ran a company. Doesn't the way the company or doesn't the way any project runs, any company, any project, anything run, start at the first chair? It's the management that makes or breaks what it is. Screening on apartments, simple matter, saves me money, saves everybody money. It saves a lot of effort and time. Bad renters are only because of bad management. And it has nothing to do with what you've built or how you've built it.
One more thing, if I may. If you think about it from your own perspective, would you go out and build an affordable housing project if you didn't know what the game rules are? If you could buy the property, go through all the development, go through all the engineering, and then at the end of the day have somebody turn it down because they didn't like the quality of the development, whatever that means, and that you would be standing, owning the piece of property, not being able to use it, you'd be out your total investment. That adds substantial risk, that adds substantial costs, and it really makes it hard to develop affordable housing. You got to know what the game rules are.
Amen.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Questions? Thank you for coming. The next panel will be Bob Rendy, John Chandler, and Don Miner.
This will be fun. I've got to make a quick note to counsel. Okay. Care if I go before you? Good afternoon, Mr. Chair.
Proceed.
Members of the committee, I'm Don Miner here on behalf of Oregon Manufactured Housing Association to speak in opposition to this measure. We see the requirement of clear and objective development standards that are known up front as the keystone to Oregon's goal of providing affordable housing. Clear and objective standards require that that requirement mandates that the city tell the developer up front what their game, the rules of the game are going to be, what they have to do in order to get approval. The opposite of that, then, are vague and discretionary standards. Examples, those are standards that are developed after the fact, and they inevitably will add substantial cost to any development. Some examples in years gone by of vague and discretionary standards were that the development must be compatible with the neighborhood and harmonious with the community as a whole. Our experience was that manufactured homes, no matter the neighborhood, no matter the quality of the home, never met that standards. Neighbors would come out and object that manufactured homes are going into my neighborhood. They're not compatible. Cities would buckle to the pressure. When there's a requirement of standards that are known up front, the city can lay them out. They can require windows, a certain percentage of windows that face the street. They can require eaves, garages, whatever. They can mandate how the home will be oriented on the site, landscaping. But those are things a person knows in advance of any decision-making. Now, I recognize this applies to developments of 18 or more, but our concern is this will be a slippery slope. If 18 to the acre is can be subject to vague and discretionary standards, why not 8? If Portland can do it, why not Salem? Why not Albany? We think the city can get the quality development once by articulating the standards up front. The handout that they gave you, some of the things that appears that they like were that parking placed to the side does not dominate the street, or requirements of windows oriented to the street. Seems like the city could articulate those standards, and folks would know what they were, and if those are the things they want, they can do it. We'd be happy to participate in a work group, but again, we see the requirement of clear and objective development standards as just fundamental to Oregon's land use process, so we'd be very hard-pressed to back away from that. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chandler?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association, here in opposition to Senate Bill 907. I think other speakers are going to make this point probably more accurately than I. The requirement for clear and objective standards has been on the books ever since Oregon's land use system started. It was honored in the breach for a good many of those years, but it is not a new requirement. It didn't just materialize. It's been part of the law since Senate Bill 100 was adopted. And there's nothing magic about the city of Portland. The problems faced by the city of Portland are, frankly, caused by the city of Portland. Every other city in the state has figured out how to live under the law that's been on the books. I don't know why it is not possible in Portland. I suspect it probably is. I'm not blind to the problems being presented to you. Nobody likes bad development in the neighborhood. Nobody likes unattractive development in the neighborhood. Portland can do design review now under the statute. It is allowed. They simply have to do it in a clear and objective fashion. If they do it in a clear and objective fashion, they can then have a discretionary process alongside of it. We passed that law back in 1997, and digging through my computer archives, I found the testimony we submitted. Mr. Miner already indicated it, but this is what reason we brought the bill forward, to say you couldn't reduce density or kill projects because of these vague and subjective standards. Were the city ordinances that said things like you had to demonstrate that a project would foster civic pride and community spirits, or sustain the comfort, health, tranquility, and contentment of the residents. Those were actual quotes from actual city codes aimed at stopping or denying multifamily development. Mr. Miner mentioned manufactured housing. Oftentimes, site design review is aimed at multifamily housing. I understand the neighborhood problems. We're not blind to those. Why we pass the law and why it's written the way it is to give cities the tool. I would refer you to Bill Close's testimony in writing. He couldn't be here today as a land use attorney from Eugene, who points out the city of Eugene has figured this out. He even gives the code section in the city code where they regulate appearance, site, and design review for units over 18 units of the acre. Apparently, it works in Eugene. I'm concerned about this bill. It's become something, version of it has come up every session since we in the early 90s. I'm just particularly concerned that this version has something in it that other iterations of the same concept have not. In the earlier versions of this bill, previous sessions, the bill left in the concept that you couldn't use site design review to reduce density or deny a project. The bill in front of you, Senate Bill 907, not only would allow the city to use vague and subjective standards, but would allow them to use those vague and subjective standards in such a way as to reduce residential density or to kill a project outright. We don't like this bill. Of the things we do not like about this bill, that is the part we find the most offensive, because that's exactly the problem that we ran into over the years of prior to the passages of the bill in 1997, where these kinds of standards were used to derail multifamily projects time and time again in cities around Oregon. We believe the process on the books works. We're more than happy to participate with Senator Monroe on a work group to see if there's some way to make it work better. We're absolutely supportive of the need for quality development. I was struck, however, by the notion that there's a part of Portland's development process that is unplanned. Many things to be said about Portland's system, but unplanned, I would not have thought it was one of them. But if there's a way to help the city get things moving in a direction that is more comfortable for their neighborhoods and their citizenry, we're more than happy to participate in that. But we cannot support this bill the way it's presented to you today. Thank you. We're glad to take any questions.
Questions, Senator?
No, thank you.
Mr. Rindy.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee. I'm Bob Rindy, Department of Land Conservation and Development. And I'm here to express strong concerns with this bill on behalf of the department. As you've heard already in testimony, Goal 10, the statewide housing goal, has as its fundamental principle that cities in their design codes will have only standards that are clear and that are objective. And that has applied to every city across the state. From the early days of the program, when every city in this state developed a land use plan and development code and had that acknowledged through LCDC, this was probably the most controversial, I think, early on, but certainly that provision which LCDC, one of those provisions which LCDC most strongly enforced, and I believe every city in the state ultimately met that standard. All cities recognize, I believe, that there's a difference between having no design code and having a design code that's clear and objective. And I think the testimony that was presented in support of this bill gave the impression that clear and objective standards, the requirement for clear and objective standards, meant that cities couldn't regulate design. And I want to dispel that notion. Many, many cities in the state have design review. It's not a matter of whether you have design review or not. This standard is about whether the standards for that design review are clear, so that somebody knows what they are, whether it's a developer or a neighbor, before someone comes in with a development application, and whether they're objective as opposed to discretionary, which this bill would allow. Discretionary means terms or sentences or requirements that the decision makers at their discretion may interpret in such a manner that might end up denying the housing or reducing the density or placing requirements on the housing that would preclude the ability to build it or to make it unaffordable. So I really want to emphasize that this is not about whether you can have design review or not. The standard has never been that. If any city in this state has the expertise, and I believe a long background of a robust design review program, it's Portland. There are cities in this state that struggle to meet this standard. They would say, and I can accept that in cities that don't have a lot of planning staff, that it's hard to write a code that in every aspect is clear and objective. Certainly Portland can do that. Many other cities in the state that don't have that kind of staff have done so. And I am concerned because our staff has a hard time enforcing this code. And we've gone through a year now of a work group appointed by LCDC looking at affordable housing, trying to come up with ways, better ways, to encourage affordable housing. And time and again what we hear is we need to spend more time enforcing this requirement. I'm concerned if we let one city in the state out of this requirement, how do we then go to every other city in the state and demand that they meet it? So I'll stop there. I've handed you some written remarks, but I'd be happy to work on a work group with this and happy to answer questions.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I do have a question, and I don't know which one of you can answer this, but I guess I'm a little bit confused, because when I listen to your testimony, it sounds like this is something that can't happen because of the Goal 10 stat and the requirements require that something be clear and objective. But the way I look at this, and we have this map, this is an extension of an existing practice. There are certain areas where they're using this discretionary review now, and then now they want to do it in other areas. So now I'm a little unclear about your message to us is that they can't do this because it's not clear. So can you sort of expound on what you've told us?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bonamici, I went back through my computer hard drive. I only have files back to 1995, trying to remember when exactly the language carving out the central city of Portland was inserted. The only exception right now in the law that allows vagrant subjective criteria is for the city of Portland at their request, and was done sometime over the last 15 or 20 years. What the city has done repeatedly since then is try to, with various pieces of legislation over the years, try to go into other areas of the city with similar vague and subjective criteria. The law applies every place other than Central City, area identified in a formally adopted Central City Plan or a regional center as defined by Metro in a city with a population of 500,000 or more. That's the only place where you can do the type of site design review that we find objectionable. Every place else in the state, including every place else in Portland, you have the clear and objective standard process that has been working and continues to work. So our objection here is not that they can't do it in other places, or the city on their map can't show other places where they might like to do it. We simply don't believe that that's in keeping with what we have done over the years. The carve-out, as I recall, was simply because the city made a case that the downtown area of Portland was substantially different from other parts of the city. And frankly, the high-rise development projects, I can't speak to how those are designed or built. It's an entirely different financing process, an entirely different construction process. You get out of the neighborhoods where you're doing the types of garden apartments at 18 units. My members build those. I do understand that process, and I understand how easy it is in other cities to do the kind of regulation that Portland is having trouble with. Does that help, Senator?
It does. Thanks.
Sure. Mr. Chair, if I could also answer.
Go ahead, Bob.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici, I do recall this provision, this exception being placed in the statute, and I don't have as good a recollection as Mr. Chandler. I think many of the points he made are correct, but I particularly remember that it was the historic nature of the downtown area that was stressed in passing this legislation, that only here do we have high-rise historic buildings that are very unique in and of themselves, and that that in itself demands a special ability to consider on a unique basis in each place the neighboring historic building that might be of a special character. That's all I remember. It was a while ago.
That clarified. I missed that it was a statutory exception. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Clear and objective standards is sweet music to my ears as when I think back in my previous life. The last, looks like we have the last panel. Greg Winterroud and Ed Sullivan and Andrew Stamp.
Good afternoon, Senator Morris, members of the committee. I'm Ed Sullivan. My address is 4004 Northwest Thurman in Portland. I'm speaking for myself. I've handed in testimony given on the previous version of this bill in the last session by Bill Close, and some additional testimony given by my other former partner and friend, Al Johnson, both of which are in opposition to the bill. I also oppose the bill. I come from a perspective of 8 years in public practice, local government, state of Oregon, and 32 years in private practice. I eat, sleep, and breathe land use, and I have enough background in this to be dangerous. I also am the chair of the board of Housing Land Advocates and Affordable Housing Advocacy Group. I'm not speaking for them today, but A lot of my more recent work has been in the area of affordable housing. I was part of the coalition in 1979 that Mr. Chandler and Mr. Miner referred to. It dealt with how to make the treaty that this state historically has made between preservation of farm and forest land on the one hand and the assurance that appropriate development would occur within urban growth boundaries. That was the deal made in 1979. It was part of the so-called St. Helens policy that LCDC first adopted to interpret Goal 10 to assure that housing would occur, affordable housing would occur within urban growth boundaries. It was part of the Goal 10 rule that was adopted by the commission in 1979 and is still on the books, and it's part of the practice of LCDC in both acknowledgement and periodic review. The coalition that supported the clear and objective standards ranged from 1,000 friends and local governments to the Home Builders Association and the Manufactured Home Dealers Association. All of them realized at that time that we had to have an arrangement to assure that development would occur inside urban growth boundaries, or else there was no excuse for restricting it outside of urban growth boundaries. What that treaty did was to say that there had to be enough land planned and zoned for housing, all forms of housing, and that you couldn't get in the back door to stop that affordable housing through unreasonable cost and delay. That's what 197.307 says. Cost and delay in this context comes from the requirement to hire lawyers, even though that's normally a noble thing in my field, architects, planners, and others to ensure that the program gets through a discretionary process. It takes time. It takes money. There was a fellow who testified a little earlier that good design does not cost more. I don't know what planet that guy came from. If you have a contentious project, there'll be some way to find a way to get at that. And the more discretionary provisions you have, the more hooks you have for getting it denied or for appealing it until the cows come home, and particularly in affordable housing, that will kill the project. Right now, there's a dual track. The city of Portland can have clear and objective standards and a discretionary process. The only thing is, you can't go after somebody for denial of the project or reduction in the density. The bill that was introduced the last time was bad enough, but as was already pointed out, this bill says nothing about either of those. Maybe that's trading stock for coming back and doing something different and declaring victory in Vietnam. This is a bad bill to begin with and shouldn't be the subject of any trading at all. The city of Portland can do clear and objective design standards. It can do them district by district if it wishes. It has the resources more than any other local government in this state to undertake its own design standards. It's just that they can't screw around with development because they want to. Clear and objective is exactly what the development of affordable housing needs. What is schlock? What is livability, compatibility, unnecessary cost and delay? That's all in the mind of the beholder. It's all what generates litigation. It's what generates cost and delay. One of the people who testified earlier said that Irvington's a pretty good example of a design community. Irvington was never under design review. That was done because the developer wanted to do it. This is an effort, in our view, to undertake Portland exceptionalism. We're different. We're better than the rest of the state. But it will take, if this is passed, more city staff to review, to do staff reports,
to undertake the hearing process. There will be more hearings. There will be more continuances. There will be more appeals. There will be an effect on LUBA. So if affordable housing, this will often be the last straw. It's our hope that you will not pass this legislation, that you will allow Portland to do what everybody else does in this state, and apparently does a lot better because nobody else is asking for the exceptions that Portland's asking for, and let them design correctly. If there's an issue over cracker boxes, where was Portland in doing the initial design requirements? If there's sight line problems, where was the city in undertaking those designs? The city of Portland is not some pitiful, helpless giant. It's no better and no worse than the rest of us. I ask you to not pass out this bill. Thank you.
I guess I'll go next.
I apologize. I have a cold, but it was important for me to be here. My name is Greg Winterode. I have been a land use planner in Oregon for 30 years. Our firm works with neighborhood associations, private developers, cities, counties, and even occasionally for the state of Oregon. As has been stated many times today, this policy is 30 years old, the St. Helens policy, the clear and objective requirement. It is the hallmark of the state's affordable housing policy. Without it, there is little left other than zone enough land within a UGB and hope for the best. When I saw the photographs presented by the city of Portland showing the parade of horrors, I can tell you that most cities I work for that are 10,000 people or more would not allow that to happen because they have clear and objective standards which would prohibit it. I felt offended by that because Portland does have the resources to do clear and objective standards that would stop virtually all of those horrors. The other thing I'd note is that we actually looked at a couple of the projects that were cited as being slums. We would note that on two of them, there were no vacancies. Real people live in those slums. That is called affordable housing. And I agree with Mr. Sullivan. When you go through a protracted design review process with subjective standards, many times housing costs increase dramatically. They increase because design review fees increase, because they have to hire people like Ed and Andrew and myself to either represent the developer or represent the neighborhood because nobody knows what the standards are. You then often get more appeals. You increase the price of the housing itself because of increased materials, increased design cost. And then it goes on to the Land Use Board of Appeals for review because everybody believes that a standard like compatible with the neighborhood means something different. If we had more time, we could bring many, many builders who would come and say, you know, the Portland review process is no cakewalk. When those who have gone through design review, and when I heard Mayor Adams say it has been successful for the last 30 years, that's simply not true. Successful from whose point of view? I have an example of a developer in Portland North Harbor who went bankrupt. And the primary question was whether the development was delightful enough. And after four or five design attempts and finally getting approval from city design review staff, the building was built. Personally, I don't think it's much better than the original design. Portland should not take it upon itself to undermine policy that is 30 years old in the state that applies statewide. And I think it would be a terrible mistake to believe the ugly house stories you've heard today and not ask the question, why can't the city of Portland do what cities throughout the state have done and adopt clear and objective standards that actually require things like front porches, adequate sight lines, parking behind the building. They're not numerical standards, just as Mayor Adams indicated. They're clear and objective, something that you could look at. So a front porch, you know, with its 8 feet wide and 6 foot deep, is a clear and objective standard that could be imposed. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Andrew Stamp. I'm a land use attorney in private practice in Lake Oswego. I listened to Senator Munroe's and Mayor Adams' comments a few moments ago, and I was struck by the fact that the objectives that they talked about and they were advocating for would be utterly thwarted by this bill. Let me be clear. This bill is not about helping poor people have affordable housing. This bill is about granting the power to the city of Portland, to a power that no other city has, and that is to have ultimate discretion to approve or deny projects for whatever reason they want. It's about the simple question here is whether or not the city can require discretionary standards, and those standards are adverse impact to the neighborhood, compatible with surrounding development, safe interrelationship among buildings, parking, circulation, open spaces, and landscaped areas, things like that, that when you look at them, you say, what does that mean? I don't know. And as long as you can't figure out what it means, that gives attorneys like us the ability to argue about what it means and delay projects for years. And what we know about that is delay can oftentimes kill a project. Because I'm a little bit of a pack rat, I actually have a copy of the St. Helens policy that people have been talking about, and I'm going to give you copies of it. I urge you to take a moment to read it. It's not very long. But this policy has been a cornerstone of Oregon's land use for over 30 years. And what essentially the city of Portland is expressing disagreement with this policy. It's saying that, you know, discretionary is good. Well, discretionary is not good for affordable housing. I will turn this in. And hopefully you'll have a chance to look at it. You know, this is not about decreasing crime. This is not about shoddy materials. It's not about having common areas. All of those sorts of things can be accomplished with clear and objective criteria. But what happens is if you have a discretionary criteria, it gives the city more leverage to demand really whatever they want. And that's what causes the problem. You heard an architect mention that he favored design review. Well, I think it goes without saying that architects will favor it because it's more work for them. I mean, frankly, it's more work for attorneys like me and Ed. But we're here because not on our own self-interest, but because we know what this will do to affordable housing. And finally, I'll be real brief. On a personal note, I've opposed the city of Portland on projects, and I can tell you that's not one jurisdiction that you should give an inch of rope to because they'll take a mile of rope. And no better example of that is in the use determination statute. In 1993, the city of Portland came to you with a real problem and said, you know, we have to have an exception in the definition of permit because we make all these decisions, thousands of decisions every month on whether a use is allowed in the zone or whether it's not. And that shouldn't be a land use decision that we have to send notice to everyone. And the legislature said yes, and they created an exception called a use determination. Well, no sooner did the city have that than they used that process to get all their little pet projects through, like, for example, when they did a process to get their reservoir covered. This was a project that affected tens of thousands of people in Portland and ultimately failed on political grounds, but they used that statute to thwart a land use process for something that was very important. And they've done it on other cases like the Holocaust Memorial and other things like that. So, you know, when the city of Portland says, oh, you know, we'll be reasonable, don't believe them. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
More comments?
Senator Morris, I know you serve on the land use committee. Not on the land use, but I know you're familiar with issues on land use and
much more than I would ever
want to know. Yeah, and frankly, sometimes we disagree on things. I'm a planner, and we don't always see eye to eye. But to me, an analogy that is worth considering here is that we hear often in this process how counties cannot be trusted to manage resource land effectively. The state knows best because we have statewide interest. That's why we need to have EFU statutes, Goal 3, and the like. To me, the same logic applies in some cases to cities, that cities are under tremendous pressure from neighborhood groups, from design professionals, from others to create pretty, to make things really nice. And who is the constituency that says, what about us? We want a place that's affordable to live in. There is no constituency. And so the St. Helens policy, the statute that Portland would like to amend, is essentially saying to the city of Portland and other cities, hold up your end of the bargain, as Mr. Sullivan said. We're supposed to allow housing within our urban growth boundaries with standards that people can understand, that can be approved, so that we have some affordable housing. We take that away, everything becomes a giant conditional use permit where bureaucrats, design professionals, design review boards decide what's the best design for the community. And that goes against the essence of Statewide Planning Goal 10, the affordable housing goal. And I think what is good for counties should also be good for cities in this case.
Thank you very much. Any questions or comments?
Well, just a comment. Very fascinating topic, and thank all of you for testifying today. I would agree with a lot of the testimony that I heard, and it really seems like, especially in our large municipalities, of which the one you're talking about in particular, you know, affordable housing really is an oxymoron. I don't know what that means anymore. Affordable means we're not going to maybe we're going to set rules and subsidies for those who are living in it, but not for the creation of it. And in my previous life and did a lot of work with the home building industry, and as a couple of people testified, the price for square foot, when you add all the subsidies in and the federal money that's put in, how much it actually costs to build some of these things, it's just ridiculous. Like, as one person testified, it's where does this money go when those same units are built for significantly less somewhere else? So affordable, you know, is used often with what is what the resident is charged to live in it, not for what it costs to develop it. And I think that's excellent. And I think I'm too as scared to death of anything that just says discretionary. It says do whatever you want, and you're a hostage taker. I just completed some work on after a year and a half of the billboard sign task force, and I can tell you when you do not have discretionary can totally erode what you're trying to do with the state. And and in the area of transportation, Mr. Chair, one of the things that we're going to adopt in this state very shortly is a thing called practical design, which is started by the Missouri Department of Transportation. That is where you build to a standard only to meet the need. And yet when you see how people want to put ornaments on every piece of transportation project, regardless of the cost, and without that permit, and we've had a little discussion, as you know, on permits, you don't have no choice. So, I would be scared to death of this because people always paint, well, this is the right objective. But when you provide language that basically says you do whatever you want, and I just think this is... The language does not meet the objective to me. So I appreciate all of your testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any other comments?
Thank you.
Okay, we'll close the public hearing. Oh, excuse me. Is there anyone that would like to speak either for or against? Hearing none, close the hearing on Senate Bill 907 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 681. Senator Boquist. And if you would like to have two folks come with you, we'll create a panel.
And I'll just quickly inform the committee, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 681 permits the State Parks and Recreation Maintenance Department to enter into an agreement with the Willamette River Channel Maintenance Group for specified maintenance on the Willamette River. It allows the group to contract with other persons or public bodies to perform this maintenance, and it authorizes the department to allocate monies from the State Parks and Rec Department Fund for the performance and maintenance activities.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. We'll be much quicker than the last event that just transpired. Appreciate the opportunity to testify before you. I'll take a little bit of time to introduce the bill for the benefit of Senator Bonamici, because the other three gentlemen in the committee have seen this I don't know how many times now. This bill I inherited from Representative Thompson, who inherited it from Representative Lane Shetterly, who inherited it from Representative Liz Van Leeuwen, who inherited it from Senator Mayee. So this bill, this concept has been around for quite a long time. We have passed a bill in the past on feasibility studies and things like that. Before I start, let me tell you what the bill does not do. The bill does not mandate anything. It doesn't tell a department it has to spend a dime. It doesn't tell us we're going to go do something. What it is a permissive bill. What this bill is about access to recreation, fish habitat, in erosion issues on a stretch of the Willamette River ranging from Senator Morissette's district, who has been on board this various times, and I simply didn't find him to get a signature on this time, all the way to Senator Schrader's district. And virtually, in fact, every Democrat and Republican between both ends there at one time or the other has been on this bill, which tells you how many times it's been around. And as Representative Butler used to say, it takes a long time to get things done sometimes. What this bill does is it does three things. The very first thing it does is it recognizes the government entity, and that government entity is the Willamette River Channel Maintenance Group, which is a Chapter 190 organization, which is the next generation of the previous Council of Governments that was involved in working on river issues on the Willamette River. So that's the first thing it does. The second thing it does is under the law is it allows the entity to submit a grant or proposal to the State Parks and Recreation Department. It doesn't say they have to give them anything. It just puts into statute that they may submit a grant along with everybody else, and they're in the queue, and they must meet all the other grant requirements that are out there, all the other project requirements, but it makes them in the same line as a county or a city who's submitting for a grant that goes in there. The third thing it does is it caps any potential grants. And if you notice, everybody else can apply, like a county or something like that, does not have a cap on there. Let me tell you where the wording came for this. The wording for the bill came out of discussions with the Parks and with Parks in the last session, in the previous session, discussions with OWEB and other individuals. And the reason the third section in there is to be able to say, okay, this isn't exactly like Speaker Hunt's organization. We're not down here deep water dredging, so on and so forth. This is a very selective operation that they're talking about, selective recreation points along the river, because there's always a large concern that somehow this bill is going to go out and dredge up the Willamette River. And, you know, put a huge dredge all the way from one end to the other. It's not what it's about. And so we put that cap in there. We put in a cap in there last session so everybody would understand this is about a selective projects to access some 40-some parks and areas along the river. And with that, Mr. Chair, I've spoken far too much, probably more than 3 minutes. I'm going to turn it over to Polk County Commissioner Tom Ritchie, who is presently, I believe, the chair of the maintenance group right now and representing Polk County.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Senator Morris and members of the committee. I can be real brief because Brian has covered pretty much what I was going to say. Works out real well.
State your name.
Oh, I'm sorry. Tom Ritchie, Polk County Commissioner.
Thank you.
I run enough public hearings, I ought to know that, right?
I'm sorry.
Bit of a brief history. I was born and raised in Independence. I remember as a kid playing along the river and seeing large boats, tugboats, log rafts, and the Corps of Engineers dredging machine in the river. The last time anybody saw that was 1973. But everybody got along harmoniously. I mean, there were sport boats, fast boats, fishing boats, all that sort of thing. And the intent here is to try and regain some of that history, if you will. The State Marine Board has spent literally thousands of dollars on revamping boat docks all along the Willamette River that mostly sit on rocks in the summertime. I've joked with people that in the summertime in Independence, where the large draft boats used to travel, you could walk across the Willamette without getting your ankles wet. I mean, it's actually true. One of the things that we have a problem with at the county level is we have a marine patrol through our sheriff's office that's responsible for helping people get off the gravel bars, get stuck, and their job is to maintain safety on the river. And half the time, they have to figure out alternate ways to get to a boat other than water. So it's extremely frustrating for them, and it isn't safe. I'm sure the captain's going to speak here a little bit about the depth of the river. Many of you may have been on his boat, and when you're standing on the gangplank or on the edge of the boat looking down, you can actually see the bottom of the river under the bridges in Salem. So our main concern is public access to facilities, parks, and the docks that have been rebuilt. It'd be nice to be able to use those. And the safety of our officers as well as the safety of the public. So With that, I'd like to pass this on to Debbie Paul, who's the Willamette River Channel Maintenance Group Coordinator and also the coordinator for the Lynn Soil and Water District.
Deborah Paul, Lynn Soil and Water Conservation District, Lynn County. I thought I'd establish the goals of the Willamette River Channel Project Maintenance and just reiterate that they want to improve navigability for the public safety, for tourism, and for transportation, to improve fish habitat by reopening historic sloughs and reducing stream temperatures, and improve river water quality through the reduction of erosion and flooding. These meet also with our Conservation District goals. I also want to talk today a little bit about the fact that I come to you because I wear several hats in both of these positions as a taxpayer, as a boat owner myself, as a farmer, and of course, as a neighbor. As a taxpayer, I'm a little concerned and frustrated that we've paid some tax dollars for this infrastructure, and I can't always access it as a boat owner. I go down and want to play on the river or fish, and you have to go to the next boat ramp because several are already rocked in, such as the City of Independence at Riverview Park or the Harrisburg Boat Ramp and also Salem's Wallace Marine Park. As a farmer, I'm concerned because annually we lose about 250-plus acres to erosion in our river. This causes a lot of sedimentation that is negative to our fish and aquatic species. It's also tough to produce local food. We hear a lot now as farmers that we're supposed to be talking about local food for transportation costs, health, safety. And as you lose more and more farm ground, that's going to become more and more of a challenge. And, of course, as a parent, I'm very concerned because I want my friends and family to be able to recreate on the river and be safe. I want them to have access, and I want emergency help to be able to reach them should that become a necessity. Finally, I point to ORS 780, which gives authorization to maintain the river and do what needs to be done to keep it navigable. So now we just need funding. So I urge you to support Senate Bill 681, and thank you for your time.
Okay, thank you. Any questions or comments?
Yes. Clarification. The bill calls for maintenance within a particular area, referred to by milepost. Could you explain where that is, please?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici. The Willamette River has been maintained for a handful of different reasons by different entities, including the Corps of Engineers, to a location, for better word, called the Newburg Pool. And while the Newburg Pool isn't exactly Newburg, if you just kind of think of where Newburg's at, that's where you find the first marker. And then if you go from there on to almost to the city of Eugene along the river is where the other mile marker is there. We used to, in days of old, long before any of us, I guess, way before any of us were born, they used to, I'm sure the captain will talk, that we used to run steamboats and everything all the way up and down to the port of Eugene, so on and so forth like that. And so that's what the rural markers are. The importance of those in there, if you'll look, there's a 1999 law that was passed and funded, and there were studies that were actually conducted at the behest of the legislature to determine those sections, which is why we've always stayed, at least all the time I've been involved in this for the three terms, we've stayed in those parameters because that's where the initial studies were done and authorized by the legislature.
Thank you.
One further point I forgot to mention was the copy that you have of the Willamette River feasibility study was commissioned by Senator, then Representative Boquist, and it really is detailed. It's about 56 pages long. It's available on a CD. We're happy to get you a copy of that if you'd like to see it. But it covers a lot of the points that have been kind of myths and misnomers over the period of time. It's really, we owe a debt of gratitude to Senator Boquist for putting that out because it was really helped our cause and helped explain a lot of things about the Willamette River. So the Coast Guard still designates the Willamette River as a navigable river. So whether that's walking or in a boat, I'm not sure. I'm not sure it's not destroyer class, but it's but it is navigable, yeah. Sort of.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Oh, thank you. Okay. The next panel will be Richard Chesbro, Kylie Stone, and Peter Jensen.
Okay.
I have a prop. Stay. Would you mind passing it around? Vice Chairman Senator Morse and committee members, my name is Richard Chesbro. I'm the captain and owner of the Willamette Queen Sternwheeler, and I perhaps more than anybody have spent more time on this river, at least in the last 11 years, than probably anybody else in the state of Oregon. This year, of course, we're celebrating the anniversary of the birth of the state of Oregon, and of course, riverboats were, as Senator Boquist pointed out, were very prominent back in the 1800s. In fact, there were 55 boats very similar to mine that traveled up and down the Willamette River from 1850 to 1916, and those were the days when, obviously, the river was much more navigable. I have a couple of handouts I'm going to be passing to you. I'm going to speak primarily to the second one, which is under the heading of my company, Willamette Queen Excursions. And these are some particular reasons why I'm supporting Senate Bill 681, as well as I supported all the other previous bills. Representative Liz Van Leeuwen and myself have been involved in this project since 1998. Admittedly, our vessel, the Willamette Queen, has been and is today the only remaining riverboat on the Mid-Willamette Valley, so it is a major tourist attraction, and we carry an average of 15,000 visitors and locals of all ages annually, and have so for the past 11 years. Consequently, I often get accused of supporting a river maintenance plan or a channel maintenance plan only because it would serve a self-interest and provide us with a lot more river to navigate. However, the truth is that this is simply not the case, as our vessel is not a speedboat. Our average speed is about 6 knots, and actually I've been very fine with the short 2-mile navigation route that the river currently allows me to operate in. Basically between Willamette Landing's, Willamette University's River Boathouse and also the Labor Exchange Bar, which both of which are within sight of downtown Salem. However, I've most of my cruises are a 1 or 2 hour period, and because we're so slow, nobody seems to mind. So I'm not concerned about going a lot further with the riverboat, although on occasion it would be fun to go up to Independence or down to Newburgh on special trips. However, my main concern is about the navigational loss of the river to the 17,000 registered boat owners just here in Polk and Marion counties, plus an additional 8,000 registered boat owners in Lynn and Benton counties who have basically found that the river is not navigable anymore, and they're forced to drive 100 miles round trip on up to Detroit Reservoir or Green Peter or Foster Reservoir or even down to the Newburgh Pool. The Willamette River is now is certainly the closest waterway for family boating, but due to the severe shallowing of the river, it has become unsafe and non-navigable. And I've seen this over and over constantly ever since I've been running on the river. Confirming this, however, which puts it in writing, is the State Marine Board's triannual report. This is the very first printing of the one that is the most recent, the one that was published in 2008. And like I say, it comes out every 3 years. And in it, it's reported that boating usage at the four boat ramps just between Independence and Kaiser has dropped 85% in the last 10 years. And it's pretty obvious when you talk to the boaters who have had this experience of running their props. And that, by the way, is a $500 prop. It happened to come off of my own ski boat, which I know the river, and I still ruin props out there when I'm on the smaller boats. But every summer, I make at least a half a dozen 911 calls, including one I made just last night, on boats that have run aground and need to be towed. Last night, of course, the State Marine Board's not even on the river yet, so we had to call the fire department to come on out and rescue these kids. Every day I pass the bronze statue of Governor Tom McCall, who I'm sure you're all aware of, whose legacy was the wonderful job he did of cleaning up the Willamette River, taking it from the most polluted river in the country to the number 10 spot. At the same time, the Governor McCall was working with the environmentalists on the cleanup of the river. He was also working very closely with the Corps of Engineers to keep the river navigable from Corvallis to Portland. In this National Geographic story, and I don't know if any of you have ever read it, it was dated 1972. There's a wonderful story in there that talks all about Governor McCall and what was accomplished on the river. But the interesting thing is, a whole part of it is they're interviewing Governor McCall from the deck of a 40-foot tugboat, and he was in the process of riding this tugboat from Corvallis all the way to Portland, and they were interviewing him for the story. And Governor McCall, in this article, recognizes that the river must serve the needs of not only the fish that are swimming in it, but also the humans that are riding on it and enjoying it and recreating on it. However, we're not doing a very good job since Governor McCall's legacy. For today, the river has now slipped from 10th place down to now we're the third most polluted river in the United States. And it's no longer safe or navigable because, believe it or not, there's a staggering 87 gravel bars that are all showstoppers for boats just between Corvallis and Newburgh. Every year, this river brings about 6 million tons of new gravel downstream with it, and that's why it surprises a lot of us that think we know the river, because the gravel bars are always moving around, and it's a constant problem. I recently had a group from FEMA aboard our vessel, and they commented that if for no other reason, we in the state of Oregon should keep the Willamette River navigable in the event of a major earthquake, which, by the way, FEMA told me we're 150 years overdue for. And because it would be the only viable transportation system that would remain undamaged as compared to our roads and our highways and our railroads and, of course, even our airport runways. So we need to reinstitute a responsible and reasonable river management plan such as we had under Governor Tom McCall, which takes into consideration all the users of the river, including the fish that swim in it, the farmers that are irrigating their crops alongside of it, and the recreational boaters that are enjoying the river. So please, let's not procrastinate any longer on this important issue. I strongly support 681. Thank you.
Thank you. Peter?
I'm Peter Jensen. I reside at 33679 Highway 228 in Halsey, Oregon. And I just want to say that I very much appreciate that this issue has been brought to the table where we can voice our opinion. I lived in the Willamette Valley for 55 years since I came to this country, first along the McKinsey River and later on farming along the Calipuya River, which is a tributary to the Willamette. And I just want to make a plea that this issue could be handled in a way that would give a little credit to us as Oregonians to be able to compromise a little bit and from going from a period of intense managing of the river to a period of time for now, since we became more aware of the fish, a time where no management at all. And the groups that seem to oppose that is for the protection of the fish, but also it becomes an exclusive group that are able to use the river as, since we no longer can boat on it. I don't own a boat. I never owned had a fishing boat because I was a dairy farmer. But at this time in life, I got very involved in the Watershed Council, and I appreciate the issues that drive this thing. But I very much hope that we can arrive at some kind of a compromise so that there can be some management in the river to protect the infrastructure that has been built over the years and the farmland and the boaters. And still, I would think, and thank you for listening, I want to very much support this concept.
Good
Good afternoon, Senator Morris, members of the committee. I'm Kylene Stone, Assistant Director for Recreation Programs and Planning at the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department. I'm here really today just to provide a couple of pieces of information for you regarding Senate Bill 681. As you know, the bill allocates up to $3 million, and we do appreciate Senator Boquist's clarification that this does not automatically obligate OPRD to find $3 million. An important point for you to understand is this funding is not currently in the governor's recommended budget, and for OPRD, the upcoming budget cycle, like all other state agencies, we're expecting some serious declines in revenue, and it would be very difficult for us to find $3 million within our funding. Also, if Measure 66 lottery funds are the source that would be used to pay for this, we would probably need a legal opinion to determine if these expenditures are an appropriate use of Measure 66 dollars. Second, the responsibility for this type of project, maintenance of river channels and docks for motorized boat recreation, traditionally has not been part of OPRD's jurisdiction. And while we at OPRD and other jurisdictions, cities and counties, own and operate docks and launches on the Willamette and other waterways throughout the state, funding for maintenance associated with the docks and the channels and any maintenance associated with motorized boating comes in part from the Oregon Marine Board and their maintenance assistance program, which is funds derived from motorized boaters and the fees that they pay for boating. So we're generally not the lead player in these stories, but just a participant in the Marine Board program. Also, thanks to Senator Boquist's testimony, if this government entity is recognized as a government entity through our rules process, we could adopt in rule the authority to give government grants to them and therefore wouldn't necessarily need statutory authority to recognize them through our government grant program, and then they could compete for recreation-related projects like other communities do. That program is a very popular program. It is funded with lottery funds. But it is very competitive, and there is no assurance that there would be resources available. And the maximum grant allowances in that program right now are at about $150,000. I'm sorry, $250,000. And so that's really all we wanted to get on the record with, and I thank you for your time, and we'll answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions or comments? Thank you.
Thank you.
Dennis Fast, Gil Allen, and Paul Donheffer.
Maybe they're not here. I don't know.
I should have gone to them first.
I don't know if they're here.
Since we're... Well, go ahead, and then we'll call the next group up.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Paul Don Hefner, Director of the Marine Board. The Willamette River is a tremendous recreation resource, but the discontinuation of channel dredging in 1976 has changed the way it's used for recreation, and probably forever. The days of using motorized boats without jet pumps have dwindled, as you heard earlier. Today there are a few pockets of deeper water here and there, but for the most part the river is limited to jet boats and manually propelled canoes and kayaks. The Marine Board does have a facility grant program that's used by local governments to improve and maintain motorized boat ramps and related facilities. We have used that for selected spot dredging around ramps. However, on the Willamette, there's so much gravel in the river that even spot dredging is almost a waste of time and money. It comes back just as fast as it's removed. In recent years, the boating access at Independence, as you heard, in Harrisburg has been severely restricted due to shifting gravel bars. The Harrisburg ramp was recently buried under about 15,000 yards in one winter event. We were successful at getting permits. It was a little bit of a miracle to try to remove some of that rock. The bid for removing the rock at Harrisburg was $250,000. However, the work could never be accomplished because the permit conditions for the work required a sediment fence be placed in the moving river, which was impossible to construct and maintain. When we went back to the National Marine Fisheries Service to try to negotiate changes to the permit, They told us flat out that they probably made a mistake, should never have issued the permit in the first place. They were not willing to amend it, so the project was canceled, and the ramp is pretty much unusable today. I know the supporters of dredging don't want to hear this, but based on our experience, permits to move large amounts or even modest amounts of gravel are not going to be forthcoming. I think that's a new reality, unless there's a fundamental shift in environmental policies, which I don't anticipate. We currently struggle to get permits for even what I would consider to be minor repairs, really small stuff, to existing facilities. Trying to get a permit to do large-scale dredging, in my opinion, would really be a waste of time and effort. There'd be one hoop after another hoop after another hoop, trying to deal with the federal agencies that control that. And I don't think at the end of the day you'd get a permit that would really allow you to accomplish what you're trying to do. If you did get it, of course, it's an ongoing process. This is not a one-shot deal. It's, as soon as you move it, it's back again. One winter event, and it's just back the way it was. To give you an example of how hard it is to get these permits right now, it's Sportcraft Landing, which is on the lower Willamette down around Oregon City. We're trying to remove just 700 yards of material from one ramp down there. Before we can get the permit or even get to talk about the permit, it's going to cost us $25,000 to do a sediment study of that material. That's 700 yards of material. It's cheaper to move it than it is to get the permit, frankly. And there's no guarantee that we're going to get that permit at the end of the day. So while Senate Bill 681 makes the Willamette River Channel Maintenance Group eligible to apply for grants, I think the real issue isn't whether they can apply for funding. It's whether permits to dredge that will ever be issued. And I think that's the discussion that really needs to take place before worrying too much about where the money comes from. And I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Your points are well made. I watched that situation down there in Harrisburg, and if they'd been able to just take an excavator out there, it would have been done quickly and not very expensively. But it's a near impossible situation dealing with the permits. I certainly recognize that. Any questions or comments? Paul? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Amanda Rich and Jim Myron.
Good afternoon, Chair Morse, members of the committee. My name is Amanda Rich, and I'm the executive director of the Oregon Recreation and Park Association, and we represent city, county, regional, district, and state parks and the employees that serve them. We, you know, signed up indicating concerns about the bill. However, after Senator Boquist's explanation, I have to say that I was, you know, much appeased by that explanation. However, it does still leave me with some questions about the necessity for the bill. Our initial concerns were around what you heard OPRD express about the lack of really any available funding in this budget cycle for this sort of activity through OPRD, and then frankly the pressure on Measure 66 funds and the applicability of those funds to a project such as this. But if you know, if the questions of the applicability of the Measure 66 funds could be overcome, and also if the entity, the Willamette River Channel Maintenance Group, or those individual entities that are a part of that group, I fail to understand why the individual entities couldn't apply. My understanding is that most of the public boat access sites along that stretch of the river are owned by cities and counties who would be eligible to apply to the local government grant program, and along the same basis as the rest of our local governments are. And so I'm curious about whether or not there's anything else that's standing in the way in terms of accessing those dollars on a competitive basis for the purposes of clearing those sites for recreation. Of course, that you know, that leaves aside the issues that you just heard from the Marine Board, which I would have to agree are going to be very, very difficult to surmount in terms of permits for dredging any large amounts of or moving any large amounts of rock. But I guess that's those are just our thoughts on the bill, that we're not really sure why it's necessary, given the explanation that the senator gave for his intent behind the bill.
So, yeah, thank you. Any questions or comments? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else that would like to speak to this bill? Hearing none, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 681 and open a work session on Senate Bill 152.
Mr. Vice Chair, could we open a public hearing and work session since this one hasn't been before the committee before? Okay. I'll let you do that.
We'll open a public hearing.
Thanks. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 152 permits the Department of Corrections and Department of Human Services to procure, contract for, or enter in agreements for goods and services to perform acts necessary for the successful management and maintenance of institutions within their jurisdictions. You do have a Dash 2 amendment before you that adds the personal service contracts to the types of contracts that DOC and DHS may enter into. It authorizes the Department of Human Services and Corrections to procure goods, services, and personal services. For institutions under public contracting statutes, it declares an emergency would take effect upon passage. We do have fiscal and revenue information before you as well today.
Thank you very much. We have Jeremy Emerson.
I promise to be brief for the record. My name is Jeremy Emerson. I am the Interim Chief Administrative Officer for the Department of Human Services. I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 152. Bill was introduced by the Governor on behalf of the Department of Human Services. And currently, as it's written, there is no fiscal impact for DHS for this bill. Just want to share just a couple of things. Basically, what it amounts to is DHS, both DHS and Corrections, enjoy quite a bit of authority to purchase and contract to run their institutions and erect new facilities. However, in the day-to-day operation and maintenance, we don't have that authority. We have to go to DAS State Procurement Office, and we've been working with DAS State Procurement Office to have them understand that this kind of is not a very streamlined process. We have the staff in both departments to actually make these smaller procurements and contracts, and we've agreed to change this, or at least propose that the current 279A be changed to provide us that additional authority. Lastly, what I would like to leave you with is that this does not change our requirements to that we would have to follow through solicitations and contracts within 279. It's just as if we were following the same process as built into our procurement code that DAS has to follow. And additionally, would be required to follow all the requirements in our collective labor agreements, collective bargaining agreements, whereby if we're going to contract out and there's any impact to workforce, that we would have to do what we call a feasibility study in those collective bargaining agreements and work with the labor to understand that they might have another proposal or another way to move forward. So I'll entertain any questions.
Are there any questions or comments?
No, other than, Mr. Chair, we hear this a lot about wanting to kind of be exempt from going through DAS because it just makes it more confusing and things. So I just kind of wonder why we just do it all, have everybody be able to follow the public contracting growth themselves. I mean,
It's a great comment. I'd like to actually address it, if you may allow me, Chair Morris and Senator Mitzer. What it also does not do is allows us to ignore the price agreements that DAS puts in place for us. We enjoy leveraging those agreements that DAS State Procurement Office goes out and negotiates solicitations and final contracts put in place by them that then we would actually leverage as a department, one of many agencies and then local governments who leverage those price agreements. So, and that's a substantial amount of purchasing that we do through those agreements the DAS State Procurement Office puts in place for us.
Okay. Is anyone else wishing to speak? Okay. Hearing none, we'll close the public hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill 152.
Senator, is it the Dash 2 that we're looking at?
As I understand
it. Oh, you got that? Okay.
Who wants to do it?
Let's try and move the DAS-2 amendment to Senate Bill 152.
Senator Cruz moves to adopt the DAS-2 amendments to Senate Bill 152. Any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, the amendments are adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 152 to the floor as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz, it's the end of the week.
It is.
Move Senate Bill 152 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I know you told me to stay quiet all day, and I've done a really good job of that. but I think we have another example of maybe the redundancy that is a clear definition of DAS.
Certain functions, yes. Okay. Is there any further discussion? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Mayor Barnucci?
Excused.
Senator
Cruz? Aye.
Senator Metzger?
Aye.
Mr. Morse?
Aye.
Chair Hatch?
Excused. Motion passes. And we need a carrier.
Well, so you ought to carry it. It's the one bill you get to move this session.
Well, this is okay. I'll carry the bill then. Okay, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 152, and we are adjourned.
You let him strong arm me into carrying that.